Good morning, everyone. Today is an opportunity. I'm sure we'll have to revisit it a little bit, but we're going to be talking about the federal stimulus and its impact on the education system of our state. And as you know, we probably don't know all the details yet, probably, but we will find out as much as we can. And we have Dr. Melcher from the Department of Education, Chaz Anderson, the Deputy Commissioner. Thank you for coming and sharing the information that you have. Dr. Melcher, or?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Tom Melcher with the Department of Education.
And
Chaz Anderson. Mr. Chairman, Chaz Anderson, Deputy Commissioner.
Welcome.
I will start out. I'll actually have Dr. Melcher help me maneuver the PowerPoint since it's a little far away. But I'll start out. We're just going to give a general overview of the federal stimulus bill as it relates to the education provisions. There's a lot of questions that we still have. We're waiting for guidance from the U.S. Department of Education, and we'll certainly keep this committee updated as we obtain more information about how the provisions will be administered.
Thank you. Thank you for doing that.
The first provision of the in the education portion of the federal stimulus bill I'll talk about is the State Fiscal Stabilization Fund. This fund provides approximately $53.6 billion to states. Right now, our estimated portion is projected to be $821.4 million, although that number is an estimate. It could change. The distribution to states is based on as follows. 61% is based on the state's relative population of individuals aged 5 to 24, and 39% is based on the relative total population of the state. The governor is required to allocate 81.8% of the funding available to support elementary, secondary, post-secondary education, and, as applicable, early childhood education programs and services. The governor must use the funds first for three areas.
Excuse me. Do you want to go through it, or would you like to take questions as we go?
Mr. Chairman, whatever you prefer is fine. I can take questions as we go, too.
Okay. Maybe we should do that. And then, members, I just refer you that you do have a slide handout in your packet. So, Senator Olson, did you have a...
Mr. Chair, it says that the 81.8% must be in support of it. What about the rest up to the 100%? The... 19.2
or
18.2. Where can that go,
Mr. Chairman? Senator Olson, those provisions are outlined in the bill. I just from recollection, I think it talked about general state services such as public safety, other supports. I don't know, Dr. Melcher, if you have the language in front of you.
Yeah,
Dr. Melcher,
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Olson, it includes public safety, other government services, but also may include elementary and secondary education. So the 81.8 is kind of the minimum that goes for education. Part of that would include dollars for modernization, renovation, and repair of school facilities. So there's some discretion on the part of the state in terms of, does the state want to spend more than the 81% for education? And if so, part of that could be used for school facility modernization.
Okay, thank you.
Is Dr. Melcher or Ms. Anderson, is there a total amount that the state would be receiving? And when I'm thinking total amount, I'm thinking like including health and human services, transportation, to get an idea of what the state of Minnesota would be receiving from all sources.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Mr. Nolan?
I don't have that specific answer, but I think what the department has put together is, and I think it's important for members to contextualize, that essentially they're going to talk about two kinds of federal pots of money. They're beginning with the stabilization money, which is the money that this committee and the governor are going to have the most flexibility to deal with. That's the $53.6 billion, of which we're going to get about $820 $21 million. I think that's the estimate from the House committee. And then there's the other formulaic money, which they haven't yet moved into, but I suspect that they will. But I think it's important to keep an eye on that. There's two main pots here, some that we have flexibility with and others that we don't.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the total amount of funds available for all spending to the state of Minnesota is approximately $4.371 billion.
Okay, thank you.
Just going into the State Fiscal Stabilization Fund, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the first three priorities, the governor must use the funds first to restore in fiscal year 9, 10, and 11, and those are state fiscal years, the level of state support greater of fiscal year 8 and 09. The second allocation must allow existing state funding increases that occurred prior to October 1 of 2008 to backfill that to support elementary and secondary education for fiscal year 10 and fiscal year 11. Number three, this involves higher education. This is the same provision, similar provision for higher education. Provide in fiscal year 9, 10, and 11 the amount of funds to public institutions of higher education in the state that's need to restore the state support for services at the FY 08 or 09 levels. And this does exclude tuition fee increases paid by students.
Excuse me, Ms. Anderson. Senator Olson?
Well, Mr. Chair, have you looked at how that translates into how it would apply to our formula in terms of that restoration?
Mr. Chair.
Does that help us in any way?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, we did not experience any reductions in education prior to October 1 of 2008. We did have, a one-time formula increase of $51 per student. We're not sure what that one-time funding increase means in terms of how the governor has to allocate these funds, if that he has to allocate that level of funding as part of a maintenance of effort. And so we're waiting for additional guidance from the U.S. Department of Education.
But Mr. Chair, what if we don't need... if our formula and what we've done in those given years doesn't require the use of the money for backfilling, then what can you do with the money? In other words, it would be possible to maintain that $51 rather than having that have been one time. That would appear to be acceptable.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, that's correct. It's likely. And we still have a lot of questions about how we're able to allocate this money, and I know that the administration is looking at sort of how this fits in the forecast and how this fits in the governor's revised budget recommendations to the legislature. So as soon as we get additional guidance, we'll know sort of how we are going to fulfill numbers 1 through 3. And then in the next slide, if those funds are insufficient to cover 1 through 3, the allocation has to be proportionate to the relative shortfalls within K-12 education and higher education. If there's additional money left over after satisfying 1 through 3, then the remaining funds, if any, must be based on the relative shares of funding under Title I, Part A. So we have to use that formula to distribute the funding available to schools. So there's discretion within, for instance, 1 through 3, and questions about how we are backfilling, or if we do have any to backfill on the state support side for K-12 education. But if any funds remain after that, then what the law says is that we have to distribute those funds based on the Title I Part A formula.
Senator Bonhoff?
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Anderson, is it possible if we do not need those funds to restore because we didn't have the cut sufficient that we might be ineligible for the money? Is that possible?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, no. It's just as if there's any monies remaining, then we have to distribute it based on the Title I Part A formula. And then the governor is required to minimally use 81.8% of it for education, higher education, or K-12 education. Going on to the next slide, allowable uses by local education agencies, that's the federal term we use for school districts or charter schools, include the Elementary and Secondary Education Act activities allowed, so that's otherwise known as No Child Left Behind, The Individuals with Disabilities Education Act or Special Education, the Carl Perkins Career and Technical Education Act, and they may also use it for any modernization, renovation, or repair of public school facilities, including any modernization, renovation, and repairs that are consistent with a recognized green building rating system. As expected, there's prohibitions by local school districts and charter schools on the funding. They cannot use the funding for payment of maintenance costs. They cannot use the funding for stadiums or other facilities primarily used for athletic contests or where admissions is charged to the general public. They cannot use the money for purchase or upgrade of vehicles, and they cannot use the money for standalone facilities whose purpose is not to educate children or otherwise known as central offices in districts. The governor is required to submit an application to the Secretary of Education in order to receive this funding, so it's not automatic to the state. In the application, the governor must maintain effort for K-12 spending in fiscal year 9, 10, and 11 at such levels that was at fiscal year 6. They must maintain effort in higher education at the same requirements on FY 09, 10, and 11 as it was in fiscal year 2006. He must demonstrate we've improved achieving equity and teacher distribution in the No Child Left Behind Act. What that says basically is an annual report we submit to the secretary that demonstrates we are making sure highly qualified teachers are teaching in our highest need schools. Just in Minnesota, we have 96% of our teachers are considered highly qualified, so we feel like we're well positioned on that provision. And then we must improve collections and use of data under the America Competes Act. This was legislation passed about 2 years ago to try to improve America's competitiveness in math and science fields.
Excuse me, Senator Salzman.
Yes. On the first point, Mr. Chair, under maintaining at least a level of fiscal year 2006, we had heard there may be an issue with that because we paid back the shift in 2006, mm-hmm. and so it looked like we were investing more in education than we actually were. Is that addressed in here? Is that going to be an issue?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Salzman, Dr. Meltzer is going to talk about that in just a moment. I'll just finish some of the other assurances the governor must make in the application. He must ensure that he's the enhancement of the quality of statewide assessments is completed and comply with the rules related to special education students and ELL students as it relates to inclusion and accommodations for those statewide assessments. Must demonstrate improvement to the state academic content standards and student achievement standards consistent with the American Competes Act. We're well positioned on that with our revision of our math and science standards underway. So we feel like we're well positioned to show that we can meet that assurance. Ensure compliance with the school improvements. So this provision, the last provision, has a lot of federal citations, but it basically means that we are providing support to schools in need of improvement and schools that are struggling under the No Child Left Behind Act. Dr. Melkacher is going to talk a little bit more about the maintenance of effort provision.
Deputy Commissioner, is that last one, are we in how difficult or where does Minnesota stand in relationship to that?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we feel like that one we can meet pretty easily. About 2 years ago, as part of our school improvement effort, we received federal school improvement funds, which we'll actually receive additional. I'll talk about that a little bit later, additional school improvement funds. And with that, we've set up, through the service cooperatives, regional centers that provide assistance to school districts and schools that have been identified as needing improvement. So we have AYP coordinators that work through the service cooperatives that provide technical assistance to those schools that need improvement. So we feel like we have a strong statewide plan, and we can meet that assurance pretty easily.
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm going to talk a little bit about the state maintenance of effort requirement. And to do that, I have a separate handout. It's a one-page spreadsheet. I've actually got information on two sides. One side refers to special education. I'd like to turn to the other side, which is labeled state support for elementary and secondary education. It's the one that's just kind of a half sheet. So not the special ed side, but the other side. And what that shows is the state support for elementary and secondary education from fiscal year 2006 through 2011 under current law, and then also under the governor's recommendations as they are currently in front of you. Part of the clarification that we need to get is exactly what does the federal government mean by state support. There are different ways of calculating that. What I show on this spreadsheet is three different ways of arriving at that number. The first one, the one that I think makes the most sense and the way that we've calculated our maintenance of effort for special education over the years, is to use the aid entitlements. That's the way the school districts recognize the revenue or state programs on their books, and it's based on 100% of the money that's generated under the state formula. So for fiscal year 2006, the base would be $6,412,000,000 under that basis. Alternative way of calculating the base would be looking at state appropriations, excluding shifts. That would be essentially, in most cases, 90% of the money for the current year and 10% of the final year payment. And the base, if we calculate it that way, is $6,345,000,000. What makes this a little complicated and creates some question as to whether we're maintaining effort or not is the shifts. And 2006 happens to be the year that we paid off the big shifts that were created in the early part of the during the 2003 session. And we paid back $607 million during the 2006 fiscal year. So if the state were required by the feds to use the state appropriations, including shifts, that would artificially increase the base up to $6,952,000,000, which would make it difficult for us to show that we were maintaining effort in the current year, because we have really more than 1 year's worth of funding being paid out in that 1 year. So if you move over to the columns for 2009, 2010, and 2011, and look at the lower portion, those are the increases or decreases compared to the 2006 base. And what you'll see there is if the state calculates maintenance of effort using either aid entitlements or appropriations excluding shifts, and whether we look at the governor's recommendations or current law, we're exceeding the maintenance of effort requirement by more than $500 million in every year. So that there's no issue at all there. The only place we run into a potential problem is if we were required by the federal government to include the shifts, and that would, under current law, require us to show that we were spending another $607 million because we had the one-time payback in 2006, and that would put us just barely over the minimum under current law, where we would have $23 million to spare in 2010 if the legislature chose not to make any reductions in K-12 spending for fiscal year 2010. Under the governor's recommendations, because we have a recommendation to do shifts, both to 90-10 to 80-20 on the payment side and a property tax shift amounting to $1.25 billion, if the state were required to calculate maintenance of effort using shifts, we would be about $1.2 billion short of what we would need to show maintenance of effort when we're comparing kind of the artificially inflated number from 2006 because of the shift payback, and then the comparable number in 2010 with the shift reduction. That would put us out of balance by $1.2 billion. We don't think we'll have to do it that way, but the law isn't very well defined in terms of exactly how that calculation would be needed to be done, and so we need to get further information on what we're required to do.
There was some discussion about a word change in the federal law, but that didn't make it in.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. It did not make it.
Okay. Do other states, Dr. Melcher, do other states use shifts as a tool for budgeting?
Mr. Chairman, I believe there are some shifts in other states, but I'm not really an expert. I can't speak to what other states do, and I suspect that the way that we've been able to shift is very unique to Minnesota, in the sense that we're kind of using the difference between the state's kind of cash basis for accounting and the school district's accrual basis for accounting, and the fact that our property tax system is on a calendar year basis, but the school districts are on a fiscal year basis. So there are some unique things going on in the state that allow us to do those shifts. And I honestly don't know whether other states have similar sorts of things or not, but I suspect other states have attempted to use those sorts of things as well, but I just can't speak to the details.
Thank you.
It's So, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Nauman?
With your permission, Dr. Melcher, even on an entitlement basis, it looks like in fiscal 10 and fiscal 11, it's 560 and 660 million above the 06 number. So, to the extent that we're looking for, I don't know if it's a K-12, but there's that kind of room, it could be reduced off the K-12 account and still maintain effort. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Nauman, that's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, there is a maintenance of effort waiver provision in the state fiscal stabilization fund provisions, but it's one that has a very narrow applicability, and quite honestly, we would have difficulty meeting that. Eligibility criteria first specify that the state or the local education agency must have experienced a precipitous decline in resources. Again, we don't know what precipitous means, but it suggests that that's a pretty steep drop in the resources available to a school district or to the state. Second one is the state would have to demonstrate that it maintains education spending as a percentage of the state budget from the preceding fiscal year. And given our pattern in terms of growth in other areas of the budget, the education area has shown some decrease over the years in terms of the percentage of the state budget that goes for education. So those are two areas that could be looked at, but I think we'd have some difficulty on both of those issues. If the state were eligible for this, the waiver provision specifies that the state or local agency may treat any funds received under state fiscal stabilization funds federal funds for maintenance of effort requirements for 1 year only. So it kind of gives you a 1 year reprieve, but then the next year you're right back up to the level you had before. So it's not a long-term fix by any means.
Dr. Melcher, on that second bullet, do they refer to general fund budgets or do they refer to total state spending budgets?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think they specify. It just talks about the total again, I think it's an area where further clarification would be needed.
Because as a total state budget, education is not 40% of our budget. It's closer to maybe 26% or somewhere around there.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's an area that where we need to get further clarification in terms of the exactly what we mean by precipitous decline and what exact categories of the budget would be included. I was assuming this was state general fund budget, and as we look at the K-12 education, for example, in relation to the growth in the human services budget, as an example, there could be some issues in terms of whether education is at the same level as a percentage of the overall budget as it was in the preceding fiscal year.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, additional funding available in the state fiscal stabilization fund beyond what we've just talked about include the state incentive grants. This is a competitive pool of money, about $4.35 billion available. The governor must submit, as we understand it, a separate application to the Secretary of Education. Each state that receives this competitive grant, they must use half of the money they receive to provide funding under the Title I Part A formula. Then the remaining half is available for the state to distribute as it sees fit, probably through a competitive process.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair, Deputy Commissioner, these dollars are still part of that 53.6 fiscal stabilization. You have not moved on to the formulaic dollars, correct?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nauman, that's correct. This is part of the $53 billion. This is still the same pot of money. This is additional funding that the state could apply for beyond the $821 million we're projected to receive under the formula and the process we just discussed. The state incentive grants in an application to the secretary must make similar assurances that we have to make in the previous application. which I just talked about, including the teacher distribution provision, the collection and use of data, enhancement of the quality of the statewide assessment system, improving the academic content standards, and assurance that we are complying with the schools in need of improvement provision of No Child Left Behind.
Deputy Commissioner, in light of this, would there be some suggestions that the department will have that would be apart from the governor's proposals?
Mr. Chairman, it's our expectation that that when the governor revises his budget, he'll include recommendations for the federal money, how that will be allocated. This is a competitive pool of money, so we won't know if we will get the money, but we will include a projection of what we expect to request in part of an application, and then what the parameters of how we'll use that funding. So we expect to have those details when we submit the governor's revised budget.
And is there any time frame that that this incentive grant money would be available to the states, or when would the federal government or the federal Department of Education award those?
Mr. Chairman, the provision in the state's fiscal stabilization fund basically says the secretary has 60 days to release the funding to the states, and the states have 120 days. And so that's sort of our general time frame. I'm certain that we'll be provided with further guidance from the Secretary of Education about timing for applying for these funds from the U.S. Department of Education, but they're under pretty strict timelines as well. I mean, they have to have the funding out to states within 60 days is our understanding. And so as soon as we have additional guidance, we'll certainly provide that information to the committee.
One final question, Commissioner. The third bullet there, could you expand on how Minnesota relates to that one, the enhance the quality? Deputy Commissioner?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, our testing program, our statewide assessment program, is fully approved by the U.S. Department of Education. That was approved, I think it was late last summer. And so we would minimally qualify, be able to say we have an approved program under No Child Left Behind. As you know, that we do have a budget proposal on our statewide assessment system as we move to the third series of the MCAs. We're always looking to improve the quality and the delivering of our statewide assessment program. And so we'll make that pitch to what we're trying to transition to, at least in terms of the MCAs for grades 3 through 8. The end of course requirement is not a federal requirement. That is a separate state requirement. And so we have two budget requests to the legislature, but we would likely not include the end of course requirement because that is a state requirement and not a federal requirement.
Okay. Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chairman and Deputy Commissioner, what will be your process to develop the grant proposals that you submit? Will you be looking for input from our committee?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, as it relates to the state stabilization funds, the governor will make his recommendation about allocating the funding to various parts of the state budget. In terms of the competitive grant funding, we will always engage. We have a stakeholders group. We always will engage legislators in that process. We will include in the governor's budget a placeholder for a request for federal funding so that if we do get awarded the federal funding, we're not delayed in spending that money. But we will provide the committee with an overview and seek their input as well.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up to that. With regard to the competitive grants, it has occurred to me that we might consider things like, technology that would increase our ability, say, for example, improve collections and use of data. There's a lot that can be done that we haven't been able to proceed on in terms of using technology to analyze scores, to influence teaching and learning in the classroom, that if we had, some funds for that, we could move towards that. For example, I carried the bill last year and the year before with smart boards. And offered to do a matching grant with business so that, you know, school districts across the state could have smart boards. Are those types of things we might consider doing competitive grants for?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, I will say that we'll need to look at the guidance as to allowable uses of this competitive grant program and another one that I'll talk about in a moment. I will say, as it relates to technology, we are projected, which I'll go over in just a moment, to receive about a little less than $6 million in the Title II Part D money, which is our technology money, which is sort of what you're talking about, to help districts and the state improve data collections and improve technology infrastructure. So that we do have additional money in this bill for those purposes beyond this particular competitive grant program.
Thank you.
Just jumping back to the schedule, if legislative changes or statutory changes need to be made, it could get awful tight toward the end of session if we end on time, which I hope we do. So if there are recommendations that need to be addressed in a, you know, a legislative way, it would be helpful to have those recommendations so that we could actually incorporate those in you know, the process. And then do you know, Deputy Commissioner, if the Tidings Amendment applies?
Mr. Chair, we actually, you guys are really quick. We will talk a little about the Tidings Amendment towards the end of the presentation. I don't know if Dr. Melcher, if you want to talk about that right now.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of any change that would suggest that the Tidings Amendment does not apply, at least to the special education piece of this, but I really am not positive about the other pieces, and it's something we need further clarification on.
Right, Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as it relates to legislative changes, you know, we were in discussions with the administration about that, and so I think that the intent is to provide the legislature with legislative changes needed for all areas of the budget as it relates to this particular federal bill. So we do have that. We are looking for any possible legislative changes that we need earlier rather than later. The next funding under the State Fiscal Stabilization Fund is called the Innovative Fund. Within the $53 billion, the Secretary may reserve up to $650 million to establish an Innovative Fund to recognize eligible entities. Eligible entities include local education agencies, and this is school districts or charter schools, or a partnership between a nonprofit organization, either one or more local education agencies or school districts, or a consortium of schools. In this case, we expect that we would anticipate, based on the language, that the local districts would directly apply for this funding. There is no provision for the state to apply. The Innovative Fund, the Secretary must award entities that have made significant gains in closing the achievement gap, entities that have exceeded the state's annual measurable objectives for two or more years, or have demonstrated success in significantly increasing academic achievement in all groups of students, made significant improvement in other areas such as graduation rates, increased recruitment and placement of high-quality teachers and school leaders, as demonstrated with meaningful data, and they've demonstrated they've established partnerships with the private sector, and the private sector will provide matching funding. The work of this fund must allow eligible entities to expand their work and serve as models for best practices, allow eligible entities to work in partnership with the private sector, philanthropic community, and identify and document best practices so they can be shared and brought to scale. Mr. Chairman and members, inadvertently we missed one slide that was dropped from this PowerPoint. This is what Mr. Nauman talked about. We're sort of now done with the State Fiscal Stabilization Fund dollars available and parameters. The second area is a separate area, and it's sort of confusing because within the complete bill, a lot of times we'll use the same formula to distribute funding, so people think it's all part of one pot of money, but there's separate pots of money. There's $87 billion available to states for Title I purposes, and this is a formula that's distributed from the is given to the state, and the state distributes that to school districts and charter schools. There's four basic formulas within the Title I Part A formula. The requirement on this group of money, the $87 billion, is that we use what's called the EFEG and the targeted formulas, which is a little bit different than what we use for our overall Title I formula. This allocation is done. It's based to districts, and it's based on census data, not free and reduced lunch students. So when the state receives the money, the state allocates that to school districts based on the census data, and then the school districts will allocate that funding allocated to sites based on free and reduced lunch students. So it's a little bit, it's similar to this Part A formula that we use normally, but we're just looking at two different areas, the targeted EFEG, to get those monies to districts, and then the districts distribute those to the school sites.
Can I just make one correction?
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify the dollars under the Title I formula, the total at the federal level is $13 billion, and it's $87 million available.
That's what I meant. Sorry.
The state of Minnesota.
I meant $87 million to the state. In addition, within this funding is included the $5.8 million, as I talked about, for Title II Part D. For the technology enhancement grants, we talked about that. Senator Bonoff had a question on that piece. There's also additional monies available for the McKinney-Vento homeless. This is competitive grant money. We do not know how much yet because it's based on the number of homeless students that we had for the 07-08 school year, and that data is still being finalized. And then the third part of money, which is about $27.2 million, is for school improvement funding. This, again, is funding that comes to the state. It's competitive to local school districts. We currently do have funding in the state for school improvement. We use that funding to send grants to schools that have not made adequate yearly progress and are in the process of restructuring, or those schools are in need of improvement.
When does our census information get either updated or calculated so that you will know what that census information says?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the census is done every 10 years. This is not going to be impacted by the census being redone in 2010. So I imagine that formulas we've used in the past will continue to use those same formulas.
Right. We're talking about the general census, not the school census.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair,
Mr.
Deputy Commissioner is correct that we don't have the data for the McKinney-Vento calculations, but the House has done a calculation based on the previous year's data, and they estimated $612,000. So it's not a huge pot of money.
For the homeless?
Based on the previous year's homeless data.
$612,000.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we try to give general numbers of how much will be available. That number is a moving target as data gets finalized and as we get final guidance and actual funding from the federal government. So I hesitate to throw it. We're actually absolutely going to get this much amount of money because that is subject to change as we receive data and guidance from the U.S. Department of Education. So if you see our hesitancy, I don't want people to walk away thinking these numbers are absolute solid and then finding out that it's less or more and why is it different. So,
okay. Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and members, next we'd like to move into the federal special education funding area. That's the second largest piece of the bill after the state fiscal stabilization part. This money is providing additional funds for IDEA. What I would do is provide a little bit of background on what we're currently doing and then how this fits into the picture. So our current federal allocations for IDEA are in three areas. We're receiving $180 million under Part B, Section 611, which is to provide special education services to children aged 3 to 21. We also receive $7.3 million under Part B, Section 619, which is a preschool program, ages 3 to 5. And then we also have Part C dollars, about $7 million. So that's our current level of federal funding. Under the stimulus bill, there's a total of $11.3 billion available for Section 611, $400 million for Section 619, and $500 million for Part C. We've received various computer runs, and they don't all agree, but the best we can make out at this point is that $189 million is available for Part B, Section 611. I'm guessing that about $3.2 million is for Section 619, although I've received two different runs. One of them suggests that the $3.2 million is part of the $189, and the other suggests it's on top of that. So there's a little bit of uncertainty in terms of the total, but we know the ballpark. And then we have about $5.8 million for Part C, which is for the early childhood programs.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Melcher, that is, are you saying that it's only $9.8 million more over the 180? So
no.
It will be up to 180, or is this 189 additional?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, this is additional.
So
this is over 2 years.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, Dr. Melcher, how can that be used? Are they increasing their share of the total costs that they will pay, or is it money that has to be spent in addition to what is currently being spent on special education?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, that's what I was going to talk about in my next slide.
Okay, sorry.
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, on the next slide, we show the uses of the money. Basically, the standard rules for using federal special education aid all apply. So funds must be used for the excess cost of special education. We have a maintenance of effort rule. There's a 50% rule that I'll explain that will apply. And as far as I can tell now, the tidings amendment applies, which would mean that the school districts would have 27 months to obligate the funds. This next chart shows kind of how this will affect the level of funding. Back in 1975, when the federal government got into the special education funding business, they authorized funding for up to 40% of the excess cost of special education. We've never come close. What this shows is the trend over the last decade, where we've, in 1998, the feds were funding about 8.9% of the excess cost of special education. We're currently at about 15.5%. What this bill would be to raise that percentage up to close to 24% for 2 years, and then it would drop back down to about 15%. So we're looking at a temporary 2-year increase in the level of federal funding for special education. We're still not nowhere close to the 40%.
Dr. Melcher, you don't think that this could become habit-forming?
Mr. Chairman, it would be nice, but I wouldn't bank on it.
Senator Salzman.
So if I have this right, Mr. Melcher, Mr. Chair, this is basically, it would address the cross-subsidy. Is that another way of putting this, that it would pick up the additional excess costs so that a school district wouldn't be subsidizing from their general fund? Would that be another way of looking at this?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Saltzman, if we didn't have maintenance of effort issues, that would be the case, but we do. And I will explain this a little further. I think the short answer is no, this is money that needs to be used for excess cost of special education, and there are some temporary things we can do to basically use this to replace some existing spending, but some of this is going to drive new spending, or basically the school districts won't qualify for the money. So there is a requirement that you have to use this for additional costs of special education, and we still have our supplement not supplant rules in a place. So you can't just say we've been spending this with local dollars, now we're going to use federal dollars to cover the same cost.
No. Senator Salzman.
So perhaps, Mr. Chair, if I could just maybe ask that you would possibly address this in your answer then, is this policy then saying that we should be spending more on special ed as opposed to could we use some of these dollars for early intervention programs or some of the things that we're trying to do to actually hold down special ed costs because we're trying to address children's needs better? That's, I think, the dilemma I'm trying to understand here.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Salzman, I understand the dilemma. I think some of the later slides here will touch on the answers to your questions. I think it would be best if I go through these and then you could ask some additional questions to clarify. So let me just first explain how we allocate the current money for special education and how this will change. The federal formula is in three parts. The first part is a base formula where the state gets $55 million every year. It's the level of funding we got in federal fiscal year 1999, and it's a grandfathered amount based on the 1998 special education child count for each school district. If a school district has charter schools that have opened since 1999 or expanded, what happens is that base amount gets divided up between the school district and the charter schools that are located within the school district. This piece of the funding is not going to be affected by the stimulus bill. It's sort of the equivalent of transition revenue in our system, where it's a frozen dollar amount based on old data. The other two parts of the federal special education formula are used to drive all of the new money that goes to school districts. And 85% of any new money, which is currently $108 million, goes out based on total K-12 enrollment, which is based on the October 1st MARS count and also includes non-public enrollment. So currently we're allocating about $92 million just based on the total overall enrollment in the school district, not special education, total enrollment, everybody. And we also allocate 15% of the money based on poverty, and we have chosen to use free and reduced lunch count as our measure of poverty for purposes of that allocation. That's how we're currently allocating the special education funding. So under this bill, we're going to be getting $189.8 million new money for Part B, Section 611, over 2 years, and that will be split equally, $94.5 million for each of 2 years. And again, 85% of the new money will go out based on the total enrollment in the school district or charter school, and 15% will go out based on the poverty level in that school. Again, this can only be used to pay the excess cost of providing special education, and it must be used to supplement and not supplant existing state and local money for special education. What can the money be used for? It can be used for hiring special education staff, contracted services, staff development, supplies, equipment. And 15% of the money can be used for early intervening services. So there's kind of a two-year period of time where if a district chose to use this for early intervening services or RTI kinds of things, it can do that. It cannot be used to cover the unreimbursed cost of staff that are funded with state categorical funds. So you can't say, you know, we're covering 68% of the salary with state funds. You can't backfill to cover the cross-subsidy with federal funds. It's basically for hiring additional staff, not for covering holes in the existing budget.
Dr. Melcher, Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Melcher, if it says that it must be used to supplement, not supplant, and we are falling short of paying our full share of special ed costs, and therefore the school districts are using a cross subsidy to pay for those costs, why would that be supplanting state and local funds, given it's not a categorical, it's coming out of the school district's, you know, general fund or general formula?
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonhoff, the way the feds look at it, they have us do two maintenance of effort calculations. And the first is a state-level maintenance of effort calculation that essentially requires the state to spend at least as much state appropriation, categorical funding, on special education as we did the year before. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the second page of the spreadsheet that I provided earlier is showing how we do our calculations. And you may notice I calculate this based on entitlements, not appropriations. But what it shows is the state has maintained effort for special education over the years. There was 1 year in 2006 where we just barely made effort. We were $430,000 more than we needed to spend in order to maintain effort. If the state failed to maintain effort, in other words, if we didn't spend as much state categorical money on special education as we did the year before, then the feds will basically disqualify us from receiving federal special education dollars. We'd be penalized in our federal special education dollars. So that's a state-level maintenance of effort requirement. There's also a local maintenance of effort requirement, and when the federal government looks at that, they look at both state money and local money. It's basically the total amount that the school districts are spending for special education, excluding the federal funds. So they require each school district individually to spend at least as much on special education from state and local dollars as they did the year before. But they do have an exception to that rule that's called the 50% rule. And that's part of the standard special education calculations. And the 50% rule is going to apply to these new dollars as well. And so what the 50% rule does is it says that in a year when a school district gets an increase in federal special education aid, which will happen in every school district in Minnesota between this year and next year as this $94 million comes in, they're allowed to take 50% of that increase and treat it as if it was local money. In other words, they're allowed to basically supplant with 50% of that new money, and then the other 50% is supposed to be used for new additional special education expenditures. Now, some of that might be paying for inflation on existing staff. Some staff will get increases in pay, and that some of that will go for that purpose. But basically, the federal rule is in the first year you get an increase, 50% goes for new expenditures, and 50% can be used to basically supplant what you're currently doing. But the catch here is it's only for 1 year. Just to give you an example of how that works, if you take our current federal funding, and let's say I've just given you an example here where we're receiving $200 in federal aid, spending $1,000 from state and local funds. The reality is if you add six zeros to these, you're pretty close to what we're really spending, but $200 million in federal aid and about $1 billion in state money, okay? So in fiscal year 10, we're getting something close to a 50% increase in the federal special education aid. So it goes from 200 to 300 in round numbers. So under the federal 50% rule, if in my example we have a $100 increase in federal special education aid, you apply the 50% rule. So what that's saying is that we can treat $50 in that year as local funds. So for that 1 year, we can reduce our state and local effort for special education, basically kind of reducing the cross-subsidy, if you will, for 1 year. But then in fiscal 11, we're getting another $94 million. So the way the feds look at it, there's no increase between fiscal year 10 and fiscal year 11. They already increased it in fiscal year 10. And so in fiscal year 11, since there is no increase, the 50% rule doesn't apply, and the school districts have to go back to the old base, which is to spend, in my example here, $1,000. So I think what I'm saying here is that the increase in federal special education aid is going to create a one-time opportunity for the state to kind of buy down the cross-subsidy, if you will, for 1 year only by half of the amount of the increase, which is roughly $50 million. And then the year after that, we go right back to where we were before. And now we have a new federal, basically a requirement to spend all of that new $94 million for additional costs of special education. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean hiring more staff. Some of that's going to be used to pay for inflation on the existing staff that you have. But it doesn't mean that we can take that $100 million and apply it to reduce the cross-subsidy and reduce state effort. If we reduce state effort, then we're in trouble in terms of the statewide maintenance of effort criteria.
A couple questions, but one is, if we do not comply with the maintenance of effort, do we end up losing all of the federal dollars, or do we just lose a portion of what we don't comply with?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have to go back and do my homework on that one. I'm not positive.
And then, Mr. Nauman.
So, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Melcher, based on your testimony, is it fair to assume that we could, if there were the will, take a one-time reduction in, say, fiscal 10 off the state aid appropriations to special ed equal to that $50 million or so and still comply with the maintenance of effort?
Dr. Mr. Melcher? Chairman, and we go back to our maintenance of effort requirement. There's two pieces to this. There's a state maintenance of effort requirement and a local maintenance of effort requirement. I don't think there's any waiver in the federal law that allows the state to reduce its effort for special education. It says basically the school districts can use half of that new money to basically supplant. So they're still spending money on special education at the local level. They're just spending half of that increase in federal money for special education instead of taking money out of their general ed formula dollars to pay for special education for that 1 year. But the state, I believe, is required to maintain effort, and I need to go back and reread the federal law in terms of whether we lose all of our federal special education aid or just an amount. If a school district doesn't maintain effort, then what happens to them is that we have to take part of their general education aid away, write a check to the federal government equal to the amount that they fail to maintain effort. So if a school district was $500,000 short of maintaining effort, we take $500,000 of their general ed aid and write a check to the federal government to pay back what they were short on. And we've only done that once since I've been working on this, and that was a charter school for, I think, about $20,000.
Okay.
But that could happen.
Mr. Chairman.
Deputy Commissioner.
I might want to just add some historical information on the state effort for special education. As you may recall, in 2005, we proposed, it was between $10 to $15 million in state special education aid, or we minimally needed that amount of money to maintain effort, or else we would fall short of that effort and would have to pay penalties to the federal government. So the legislature did adopt that proposal so we wouldn't fall short of meeting that maintenance of effort. So we have that issue has come before this committee and for the legislature. We just minimally met the requirements at that time in 2005. It hasn't been an issue since then because in 2007 a substantial amount of money was put into special education, and so we haven't had that issue hasn't come up in the last few years.
A couple questions, Senator Hand and then Senator Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to make a comment, I guess, initially, and that is that I just want to remind people that this is unconstitutional and we shouldn't do it, but I know nobody cares about that, but I just wanted to make that point, that there's no provision in the Constitution for the federal government to be funding special education at all. But setting that aside, Dr. Melcher, what I'm curious about is if we do this, what kind of long-term obligation does this put on our budget to continue to fund or increase our funding? Or are we, if we get into this accepting of this additional money, are we going to be in a position in a couple of years of having an even higher obligation to maintain that if the economy doesn't respond, that we're just going to have an even deeper hole to contend with. I'm just trying to understand how this works and whether this will make our long-term problem better or worse, or does it not make any difference at all?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, I think there are two issues here. One of them, I just went back to this federal funding chart here again. So part of the issue here is if we get this two-year bump in federal special education aid, and school districts use that to hire more special education staff. And then, you know, depending on whether the federal government decides to continue this or not, we're showing it's a two-year increase, and then it goes back down. We could be in a situation where the school districts are either going to have to cut special education services, or they're going to have to pick that up with state and local dollars, which could conceivably increase the cross-subsidy in 2012 when the federal money runs out. From a state maintenance of effort perspective, if we go back to this state level maintenance of effort requirement on this chart that I handed out earlier, basically the requirement on the state is to spend at least as much federal special ed, at least as much state money for special ed as we did the year before. So anytime you increase the federal or the state spending for special ed, that increases the base for a future year. So, for example, back in the 2007 session, there was a 25% increase in the state funding for special education as a result of the Senate bill, which was attempting to fully fund the state formula for special education. Well, that permanently increases the base for future state funding of special education. So we're required to spend each year on special education at least the same amount of money that we spent the year before. Or if we have a decrease in our number of special education students, we can proportionately reduce it for that. But we haven't had any decreases. So effectively, the floor becomes whatever we spent the year before becomes the base for the current year.
Mr. Chairman.
Just to remind members that the package in 2005, I believe, that's when we increased our special ed?
Seven.
The discussion back then was a combination of we would try to increase our special ed spending. At the same time, we'd try to increase some of the early childhood programs and preventative programs to counterbalance the long-range growth of special ed. And I still think that that's a one way to work our way into a greater stability in our special ed costs, but also to help those children early and not get into the system, because and I'm not sure where this information comes from, but once children get into the system, it's very seldom that they get out. But if they do not get into the system and have a level of basic prevention, then those costs will be much reduced over those school year. Senator Hand first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dr. Melcher, and I just want to make sure that we're clear about this. As I understand what you're suggesting here is that the federal money that comes in, part of it, as Mr. Nauman mentioned, could be used at the local level to offset some state spending, but we'd be a little careful apparently about how we do that. But essentially, the federal money can be used to hire staff or to implement new programs or do new things. And if we assume that that federal commitment is not ongoing, then in 2 years we'll have a problem of either cutting back on all those things or finding state spending to continue that. But we would not be required to continue that, because we were not using state money to fund it. Is that correct? So that really would then become a choice of whether we're going to cut back to the previous level and eliminate the programs and the staff that we hired, or increase the state commitment to continue to fund those things, then set a new maintenance of effort threshold for the state. Is that essentially
correct? Mr. Chairman and Senator Hand, yes, that's correct.
Senator Salzman.
There. And on these same points, Mr. Chair, you said it very well that for children who do get an IEP, there's about a 95% chance that they will stay in special ed. So I think that we've worked very hard on the Senate side to really look at how we serve children better. And this is not about a commitment to children. That my comments are not reflect a lack of commitment to children who have special needs, but we will serve them better if we can intervene. So you're just the messenger, Mr. Melcher. I really appreciate that. So my question is that when we look at these early intervening services, which is your next slide, and it says that up to 15% may be used, would it be possible for the state to require a district to use 15% of these funds for early intervention? Are we able to require that states use their federal funding a specific way? I'm just suggesting maybe.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Salzman, I don't believe the state statute can override the federal law, which provides school districts a choice of either using 15% of their federal special education dollars for early intervening services, or what they can do is to use the 50% rule on maintenance of effort. The school districts have a choice. They can spend all of the federal special education money for special ed services. They can choose to accept the 50% rule and reduce their effort, count some of that money as federal, or they can do the 15%. And as I've got on the slide, it's basically saying if a district chooses to use the increase in federal money for the 50% rule, then they can't use it for EIS. The federal government also has a provision, I don't have it on the slide, which says that if a school district is identified as having a significant disproportionality, for example, by race, on students in special education, then they're mandated by the federal law to use that 15% for early intervening services. But I don't believe the state law could come in and force a school district to use federal dollars in a way that wasn't consistent with the federal law.
Okay, Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm sitting here just frustrated as all get out, so this may be a bit of a vent.
I'm
warning you. if if we were actually successful, I remember Dr. What's his name? Used to head up special ed at the federal level, saying that a very high percentage of our learning disabled, for example, and even to some extent the emotional behavioral, are results of instructional failures. If we were to be successful with some interventions with existing special ed population, and they actually didn't have to, they actually could escape, and that would be more than 5%, would we still have to maintain effort? Is it by student, or is it the total amount we spend?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, it is the lesser of the total dollars or the dollars per student. So if we had a decrease in the number of students with IEPs, that would reduce our federal maintenance of effort requirements.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, that gasket can be put back in place here now then. the other point, what is so difficult for them to understand out there when they are spending money that they don't have, and we can't spend money that we don't have, that would allow them to actually give us a little more of that percentage of what they originally authorized, rather than always putting something on top that requires us to spend more in order to use it? It doesn't make any sense. What's so difficult about that? Is the, you know, I don't want to talk about the intelligence level, but what is it?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, I know that the National Governors Association and others were lobbying to try to create a little more flexibility on the use of the special education dollars, and we're not successful in doing that. And in the one place that I referred to earlier on the exception to maintenance effort really applies to that other fund, the maintenance of effort waiver on the other dollars. So theoretically, if we met these criteria, you could use some of the, not the IDEA money, but the stabilization money to, as local effort, to meet your federal maintenance of effort requirement for federal special education. But I think these criteria are very steep and would only help you for 1 year anyway. And so it, I don't think it gets you anywhere. But that's kind of the best they did in terms of trying to have some relief from maintenance of effort.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Melcher, it's the stimulus part is to get us deeper in trouble in our own fiscal. I mean, that's kind of the effect of this.
That's what I'm concerned.
Is if we're going to, you know, try to use it, we've got to go deeper in debt and have a bigger problem. And that may be in some of the other categories as well. It's how I just can't quite understand how this becomes a stimulus.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, I think in part if you're trying to stimulate spending and save jobs, I think what this is kind of forcing us to do is to hire more staff in the special education area.
Fire them in 2 years.
As opposed to using it to pay for our existing shortfalls. And so I think this money is in separate pots. You've got the stabilization money that's to try to help states deal with budget cuts that they've made. And then you've got the IDEA money, which is a separate pot of money. And the rules on the IDEA money are the same as the rules that we've always had on the IDEA money in terms of the maintenance of effort.
It seems to me that the creativity and the new ideas are in one part of it, which is the stabilization part of it, but the same old requirements are in the other part, which it does create that cliff that you talk about, and I think states are struggling trying to figure out what the best approach is to address these long range problems. And we'll probably have to continue to do that. But I mean, it doesn't reduce the cost basically to those, you know, to the overall special education cost. So I mean, when we get right down to it, you know, either school districts pay for it, or the state pays for it, or the combination of school district, state, and federal. And I think it's we have to come up with the creative ideas on how can we lower these costs in a long-term basis, and you know, what ideas are there out there to help school districts? So,
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Olson.
I guess the frustrating part is that the leg of that three-legged stool that is participates the least financially is calling all the shots.
It's called preemption. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you just made the comment I wanted to make. And I think that on one hand, I think it's clear that we have additional money for only 2 years. We have to get back to where we were in 2 years. However, if we think in terms of how we can use these 2 years to do innovative practice, to really do business better, we have a lot of money to do that. And so the challenge is for us in terms of utilizing these resources to review what we do and our practice. And I think this is a tremendous opportunity for the state of Minnesota. But it goes back to a comment that Senator Bonhoeff made in terms of, you know, how do we use technology and who is advising you to do that? Because if you simply try to do the same things that we did before during these 2 years and then go back to say, well, now you have to get back to where you were 2 years ago because we don't have the money, we created a bigger problem because it's more difficult to go back and say, now you don't have this money, go back to where you were. So I really, Mr. Chairman, think that it is very important that we in the legislature challenge the department to really look at what is that you're going to do to bring people who really know these issues well, who can help us with innovative technologies and new practices, to really look at how can we do business in a different way so that when we run out of money, we have a new model in place and use, these are millions of dollars that we can use to do our business in a different way. And that's, we need that desperately in education. We again and again go back to the old model, and that's why we, even when we have money, we say, oh, well, this is so bad. Even with new money, there is no hope for us. Mm-hmm. And I think that is just very unfortunate. We should use this money for 2 years, but we need to include points of view of people who can help us do business better. And I don't know if we have a plan for that, but we need to put it in place ASAP, I think.
You know, one positive thing is, Senator Torres Ray, as you were talking, the positive thing is that the federal government and obviously every state government, because they're going to be, you know, talking about the same thing as we're talking about, the federal stimulus. The positive thing is that they've raised education to a much higher plateau. It's not like this money could have all been put into something else. I mean, it could have been who knows what. So actually, I think that the education discussion is occurring in every state capital across the nation. You know, how can we use the money that we're getting for innovative programs, for better education, et cetera, et cetera. So, Senator Olson, I know you had a question.
Mr. Chair, but based on some of the things you were saying, how much say do we have? If it's a formulaic and goes out to the schools, is it up to the schools to be innovative? Or what direction can come if, in fact, we have some, you know, aha moment of knowing what to do that will make things better?
Dr. Melcher?
Mr.
Or
Chairman and Senator Olson, I can say one thing, and Deputy Commissioner Anderson may have something else to say. One of the things we've done that's innovative, and I know Senator Salzman has worked very hard on it, is the alternative delivery program within our special education program. And we can continue to do that, and we've had some growth in that program in the last couple of years. One thing that I would caution you on, as we look at our statewide maintenance of effort calculation, we cannot count the alternative delivery part of the special education appropriation as maintenance of effort for special education. And so as if the legislature, for example, were to freeze special education funding, and right now you've got some inflation built in on the state side, so you could maintain federal effort by just saying, okay, special education, we're going to go back and freeze like we did in 2003. But if you did that, that would preclude the department from approving any new increases in the alternative delivery piece, because then the dollars being used for the regular special ed program would be going down, unless we actually reduce the number of students being served. So I just want to make sure that you follow that piece of it. We've got our hands tied in a number of ways, but there are some innovative things we've done at the state that are growing and that have some promise. And the feds, at the same time, are allowing 15% of the money to be used for EIS. So there's some glimmers of hope there. I
think. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melchior, or maybe Commissioner, do we ever identify children as needing special ed services under the age of 5? And if we do, then they would qualify under the regular special ed provisions of this. What I'm thinking about is if we, during these 2 years where we have this special bump, put our focus on identifying very early those children that we know will need special services. I was at a place in Forest Lake where children with really severe cognitive delays were identified under the age of 3, but by the time they got to kindergarten, they were on a par with their students. So is there a way we can focus these dollars on those students, do the hiring and the screening that we need to do, so that when we no longer have this bump, we have some children who have a step up on the scale?
I'm not sure who wants to. Dr. Melcher? Sure.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rummel, we have to go back to the slide on the different pieces of federal money. I hate to be the kind of the cold water on everything here. But here's the way the federal special ed funding works. You've got Section 611, which is for programs for children 3 to 21. And you've got Section 619 for preschool 3 to 5, and you've got the birth to 2 piece. So the increases that we're getting are mostly in Section 611, which is 3 to 21, so you could provide preschool services for that group, but not for the 0 to 2 population with that piece of it. And we are getting some money in Part C as well. So we clearly have a large increase in Part C money that could be applied specifically aside from the Section 611 dollars. So we have actually the different funding sources here that could go for that. So presumably if we're right now at 7 million in birth to 2, we're going to have an extra 5.8. Again, that's over 2 years, but it's almost 1.5 times as much money as we currently get for the birth to 2 piece. That should result in at least a 2-year bump in the ability to reach those children birth to 2. But the big pot of money is really 3 to 21.
Mr. Chair, I will add one issue. In the 2005 legislature adopted a proposal of the department to begin early screening of children, and we provide a larger reimbursement to school districts who screen the children at age 3. Used to be the mandate was age 5, and the reason for that was to if there wasn't an intervention through a medical diagnosis, that if we caught something at age 3, obviously then we can intervene earlier than age 5. So we provide districts financial incentives to screen students earlier.
Senator Bonhoeff and then Senator Salzman.
Mr. Chairman, would this committee then put forward, for example, let's say Senator Rummel has an idea that she would like us to use that money on birth to in a particular program, would she put forward a bill that has a fiscal note that then we as a body would pass that then would direct the department to use that increase in that way? Would that be our process, Mr. Chair?
Well, I think what we would do would be to find out if those programs had, what impact those programs had on the early screening and see if that's a successful model and then maybe expand that. I think that would be, we'd be working off an existing program, but one that would have a track record. And it's, yes, the answer is yes and yes, because, you know, if there's new ideas, we'd certainly like to hear about them. So, Senator Salzman.
Yes. And on that same point, Mr. Chair, and Senator Rummel, one of the things that is seen in some of the data that's coming back from these early intervention programs is that these children aren't far enough behind to qualify for special, a bulk of them, and that doesn't tend to show up a lot of times until second or third grade. And so in a lot of these early intervening services, it's really identifying kids as soon as an evaluation shows that they're starting to drop at all behind an age or a grade level, because too often in the past, I think the comment has been, oh, they're a boy, they'll catch up, or they're just learning differently. And so that's, I think, where we struggle, is that with the early intervening services, it's really getting to these kids before they're so far behind that then they qualify for special ed. So I think that that's an excellent idea of, are there children out there that aren't being identified that could be labeled as special ed because they meet the I think it's two standard deviations. But then it's also, how do we fund these programs that are absolutely, I think, the key to ensuring that we serve kids better and we hold down costs? And that's what I think is so frustrating about this, is that we are, in this federal package, they're funding failure. And that we don't have a real good track record that these children are going to catch up on special ed. And that's, I think, what's very frustrating here.
Okay. Is there any additional information that you'd like to present or questions?
Chairman, we had a couple of more slides that we wanted to finish up with, but I've got a little technical thing. Maybe if we could just refer to the PowerPoint handout.
Dr. Melcher?
Toward the end, I think it's page 16, we have a little discussion about the Tidings Amendment. I just wanted to clarify how that applies here. The Tidings Amendment allows school districts to obligate their federal funds over 27 months. And so if there's an additional $94 million available under IDEA for fiscal year 10, the school districts don't necessarily have to spend all of that in fiscal year 10. They could spend part of it in fiscal year 10, part of it in fiscal year 11, and then even into the next fiscal year. And so that money can be spread out. And then the second, you know, if there's a second $94 million installment in fiscal year 11, again, that can be spread out. So basically what this means is this new federal money could be spent by school districts over really a three-year period rather than just a 2 years, because of the Tidings Amendment allowing us to spread things out. So we don't have necessarily quite as big a peak and then quite as big a drop. It allows us some flexibility to spend. But basically, if the school districts haven't spent the money after 27 months, then it goes back to the federal treasury. The other piece that we wanted to alert you to in the bill is some new reporting requirements that Deputy Commissioner Anderson will discuss.
Mr. Chair, these are members of the committee. This includes just general reporting requirements noted in the bill. Within each of the competitive grant funding, there is additional requirements, but we just want to make members aware of some additional reporting requirements by the state and local school districts. One is reporting the use and distribution of funds, which is pretty straightforward. The second one, we have to report the number of jobs saved or created by these provisions. The third is we have to report the amount of tax increases averted because of these funds. The fourth one is reporting the progress in reducing the inequality in the distribution of highly qualified teachers, including implementing longitudinal data system, developing valid and reliable assessments for ELL students and students with disabilities. We have to report the tuition and fee increases imposed and any actions taken to limit those increases. Lastly, last two is we have to report the extent to which public institutions of higher education maintained, increased, or decreased enrollment of in-state students, including students eligible for financial aid. And this one might be quite extensive by the state and local school districts. Report description of each modernization, renovation, and repair project funded, which must include amounts awarded and project costs.
Just a thought. Yesterday, in visiting with some of the other division chairs, there is money coming in through several different sources, and one of them is through in the energy area. Is there any coordination that the Department of Education is pursuing in terms of let's say building construction or energy efficiency kinds of measures that would be apart from the area that you're addressing today? So like renovation for school districts or buildings.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have had discussions with other commissioners and other department staff. I think what you're referencing to is some funding that DEED has received. They are working on the provisions and getting additional guidance as well. So that may be additional money that schools could apply for to implement energy efficient systems and schools and modernizing facilities. But at this point, they're still trying to gather information and get additional guidance on that. But there might be separate monies that may be available outside of the education provisions for school districts and charter schools.
Would it be possible to keep us updated on how districts could participate? I'm sure that you'd probably send out notifications to the districts, but if you'd also keep us informed. Also, I think in the area of public safety, there might be some additional resources that some districts might be able to use. I know some districts are involved in that in terms of their use of law enforcement and things. So,
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there any thought going into the review and comment process for construction in relationship to monies that would be connected to the stimulus?
Mr. Chair, just one other area that I wanted to touch on as it relates to construction, and that is there is a section of the bill dealing with impact aid, and there's $100 million available for impact aid schools that's specifically tied to school construction. And so we will be contacting Red Lake District as an example, the district that qualifies for impact aid, to see if they might be able to apply for some of those dollars. So potentially there could be some help there, although $100 million spread across the country may not get them dollars, but it's something that we want to look into. As far as the review and comment process, Mr. Chair, we do expect some increase in the number of review and comments as districts may use some of these dollars for that process. It's an area we've struggled with in terms of being able to find a qualified staff person to fill the vacancy that we currently have, and we're still trying to do that.
The federal stimulus money is attached to certain time frames as to when contracts have to be let, and
2 years.
And the fear is that those contracts need to fall within those time frames in order to take advantage of that money. So if you can kind of check that out so that we don't end up so that we have a process in place, or at least keep us informed. So,
Mr. Senator, Chair, I believe it's 2 years they have. School districts have to expend the funds within the state stabilization fund monies.
Now, that would be outside of the stabilization money, so I think, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chair, I believe that there is a provision that allows school districts to spend part of their state stabilization funds on construction with some prohibitions on stadiums, et cetera.
Right.
So that's depending on what pot of money, that's dependent on what the timelines will be. But we're very aware that the process for bids and awarding a contract take time, and that the quicker we can get guidance to those school districts, the easier time they'll have implementing the provisions.
Create some flexibility for the agency.
Okay. Well, Mr. Nauman, maybe you can restate it.
Mr. Chairman, I think that what the committee might be struggling with is there a need to provide some flexibility on the review and comment process for the agency as we're dealing with some urgency to get these dollars out the door? And I don't know the answer to that, but I think we would, I think the committee would benefit for some feedback from the agency on that point.
Okay. Senator Rummel?
Mr. Chair, do we know when the clock starts running?
I think it was started yesterday.
It started yesterday, okay.
I'm not sure. Deputy Commissioner, do you know? Or?
Mr. Chair, it's usually the day of enactment or the day after enactment. So, and then the Secretary has 60 days to get the money to the states. So his clock is ticking, and then our clock will tick. But I think our goal is to get the money out as fast as possible.
Okay. Senator Terrazzari.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Anderson, I wanted to see if there is a possibility that we could engage the state in a conversation about ELL students. I think that this particular this time and this funding presents an opportunity, and California is talking about this in terms of how the state could really use these dollars to look at their ELL programs and how they serve ELL students. I think states where they have large ELL population, states are really looking at how they could really establish programs that could respond to the needs of districts in terms of technology, training for ELL instructors and teachers. And I think that this will be an excellent opportunity for us to assess our system. I have received, you know, multiple complaints from many districts in the state of Minnesota about how underfunded and really the lack of structure that exists today for ELL students. And so I think that we may look at this as a possibility for reviewing that particular process and looking at how we can incorporate innovative practices and new training for existing teachers, not to hire new teachers. That's just an idea that I'm very interested in exploring.
Thank you. Dr. Melcher or Deputy Commissioner?
I was going to say, Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to sit down with you and talk to you about that. A lot of the direct services to ELL students is done at the district level. And so if there's state policy changes that need to be made, that's the interest of the legislature, we'd be happy to work with you.
Senator Roland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I may know the answer, but I think I'll ask anyway. I often consider students that are ELL students, special ed students, because they need special education in order to function at the level of the other students. And so it is a form of special education. Are our special education laws drawn so strictly that the description would exclude them, or would there be some way we could include them into our special ed population?
Mr. Dr. Chairman Melcher. And Senator Roebling, I'm not an expert on the IEP process, but I'm quite sure that the ELL status of a student is separate from the special education status, and I'm sure we have many special education students who are also ELL, but I don't think there's an automatic thing that if a student is ELL that they're considered to be a student with disabilities under the special ed law.
Anything else that you'd like to? Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question. I believe one of the last slides there is reference to the reporting requirement for the longitudinal data system. That usually just glazes over most people, usually did for me, for most of the time I've been here. But now I know how critically important it is to have good, solid data, starting with every Minnesotan, and they're looking across the country to chart the progress that they're making. When we talk about the special education services, anyone that's at risk, they need to be identified, and that is what it's talking about. And I'm wondering if the department could give us a memo update at some point showing us the status. Millions of dollars are coming to the state to help implement the program. There's 10 quality indicators. This is information that will give us a better handle as to how to measure the effectiveness of programs, and especially for the early identification of issues. And we have some important policy issues, I think, to discuss on this as to what should be in this. And it's not just the silo of education. It gets into human services, into our correction system as well. So I just wanted to point out the importance of it. And it's just me. There's a reference in the slide, but the future implications in our planning are very significant. So I wanted to lay that out. And if the commissioner, assistant commissioner, deputy commissioner, rather, had any feedback on that, but as well a request for a memo update on that.
Good point, Senator Wicker.
Mr. Chair,
Deputy Commissioner.
Senator Wicker, the state is progressing forward with a data longitudinal system. We did receive some federal money in the form of a grant and a consortium with two other states to implement a longitudinal data system.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, did you get round two funding as well?
We have not heard back yet. That's still pending. And so this is an opportunity for the state to move forward. We're ahead of a lot of other states in terms of our data system. As Senator Wicker said, this will provide us with a lot more richer information about student, school, and school district progress over a period of time versus looking at sort of snapshot versions of how schools and students are performing. We also have entered into an agreement with higher education on a student identifier system. So after students exit K-12, they will. This is in progress. The University of Minnesota, Minsky, and the private colleges have agreed to use our data student identifier system, so we know how students progress after they leave the K-12 system and where they go in terms of higher education is if they stay in the state of Minnesota. So that's something we can provide a more thorough update. There's folks working on that that have far more information and knowledge of it than I do, but we'd be happy to provide an update if this committee would like it.
The information that's collected from the college side of it, from the university and college side of it, can we use that information, or is that strictly theirs once that's compiled?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd have to take a look at the data agreement, but it's my understanding that the department and the higher education institutions have been allowed to share the data. It was a provision passed in 2007 that allows those two institutions to share and use the data.
All right. Thank you. Senator Rummel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does that allow school districts to access that data? So what's happened to their own particular students?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rummel, it would allow them to access the data. The protection I will emphasize is that we can never release student identifier data, but the school districts would have access to the data and can look at their numbers and aggregate how their students are doing once they leave the K-12 education system.
Well, thank you very, very much. If there are no other questions or information, I want to thank you for giving this presentation. It was very thoughtful, and there are some unresolved questions, but as more information comes in, if you can keep us informed. I think education has a large stake in this federal stimulus, and I know the most important one that Senator Hahn is interested in is lowering the taxes side of it. That was fascinating to see that. I mean, that is part of it. So we'll have to figure out how we can work that in. But tomorrow we have Growth and Justice is giving a presentation on the smart investments in Minnesota students. And that is at 8:30. So if members can be sure to remember to be here, we would appreciate it. And thank you very much for showing up, and committee is adjourned.